Things are not always what they seem, and sometimes the key to solving a mystery lies waiting in place you never would have thought to look. What is up, Biwa Crew? Today we're going to explore the top 5 missing person cases that were solved with unexpected twists. So let's get right into it. Number 5, Michelle Whitaker. Michelle Whitaker, known to her friends as Shelly, disappeared in August of 2002. At 32 years old, Shelly had already been through 3 divorces and had developed a bit of a drinking problem. Her drinking made it difficult for her to hold down a job, and it put a lot of strain on her relationships with her parents. In late July of 2002, things came to a head when Shelly was arrested on charges of drunk and disorderly conduct. Shelly's parents had had enough and had asked the police to hold her in jail until a spot opened up at the nearby rehabilitation center. Unfortunately for her parents, though, Shelly was an adult. The police couldn't legally hold her on her parents' request. Shelly was released from jail, but her parents didn't hear from her for several days. At that point, they received a phone call from a worried friend of Shelly's who wanted to know if they had seen or heard from her recently. During the investigation, police later discovered that after Shelly had been released from jail, she had headed back to the bar. There, she had met a man named Brad Wines. Noticing that Shelly was acting a little strange at the bar, Brad had introduced himself and asked if she needed anything. Shelly told Brad that her boyfriend had kicked her out of her house and that she was afraid that he might come after her. The two of them decided to go bar hopping together, and at the end of the evening, Shelly asked Brad to drop her off at a truck stop. He tried to convince her that it would be better to wait until morning, as it wouldn't be safe for her to hang out alone in the dark. Shelly agreed and spent the night at Brad's house, and he dropped her off at the truck stop the next morning. Brad was the last known person to see Michelle Whitaker. Investigators were baffled because there seemed to be a lot of conflicting evidence. According to Brad, Shelly had been headed out of town to look for work, but she hadn't taken anything with her but the clothes on her back. She even left her beloved dog behind. A few weeks later, another woman from the same town also disappeared. She was a former co-worker of Shelly's named Heather Sellers. Her case also went cold, and police had a feeling the two might be connected. For 3 years, there were no new developments. On the 3rd anniversary of Shelly's disappearance, police reached out to the public for new leads. They received a mysterious letter claiming to reveal the location of Shelly's body, but a search of the area turned up nothing. Then, a development was made in the investigation of another case that spanned all the way back 10 years before Heather and Shelly's disappearances. The cold case of the brutal murder of Dana Satterfield had finally been solved, and the culprit was found to be Jonathan Vick. Jonathan Vick had known both Michelle Whitaker and Heather Sellers, and now police knew what he had done to Dana Satterfield. He became the number one suspect in Shelly and Heather's case. Police, however, were never able to find conclusive evidence that Jonathan Vick had been involved in the disappearances, and the cases went cold once again. 6 years after Shelly's disappearance, on Monday, August 4th of 2008, police received a tip from a woman in Oregon who claimed to know where Shelly was. They didn't believe it at first, because it just didn't line up with the story they knew so far. How could a woman who had disappeared under mysterious circumstances just show up 6 years later, still using her real name and completely unharmed? The woman told investigators that she was a friend of Shelly's who had stumbled across her missing persons report by accident and was calling to tell them that she was not, in fact, missing at all. Baffled by the claim, and sure that the woman must be mistaken, the investigators asked her to email them a current photo of the person she believed to be Michelle Whitaker. When they saw the photo, the police were shocked. It was the same Shelly who had been missing for 6 years. Everyone was stunned, including Shelly herself. After repeated fights with her mother, the difficulties she had with keeping her job, the drinking, and the divorces, Shelly had left home for a fresh start. After everything that had happened, she had thought that her family didn't want anything to do with her and had never even known that they had reported her missing. In a fairy tale ending for the ages, Shelly was located just in time to attend her sister's wedding, and the family bonds she had once thought were broken beyond repair were suddenly on the mend. Number 4, Lorene Roberts.
Vera Lorene Roberts went missing on February 12th of 1964. She had grown up in the small town of Dripping Springs, Texas, and dropped out of high school when she was 16 for reasons no one really knows. She moved to Austin and got a job as a waitress. She worked there for a few years, and in 1949, she met a young man who she married only 10 days later. Things were moving quickly for young Laureen, but the couple had three children and seemed to be happy for a time. In 1956, Laureen, her husband, and the children moved to New Jersey to be closer to her husband's family. Unfortunately for Laureen, her husband's family absolutely despised her, and they made no attempts to hide it. They bought Laureen and the children train tickets to travel back to Austin, and after making the trip alone with the kids, she divorced him. Now a single mother of three, Laureen worked hard to provide for her kids, but she just couldn't do it. She was forced to put the children up for adoption, and the trauma of that decision and other events in her life began to take a toll. Her emotional and mental health started to decline rapidly, and Laureen asked her sister Ruby to take her to a mental hospital, where she would check in and out several times over the next 4 years. Every time she left the hospital, she would find a new job as a waitress, where she would work to earn a living until the pressure would get to be too much and she would return to the hospital. It was a vicious cycle, and Laureen couldn't seem to regain control of her life. Sometime in 1959, Laureen visited her sister Ruby out of the blue. She broke the news that she was engaged to a new man, a college professor. Ruby could tell that something was off about Laureen that day, but she had no idea that it would be the last time she would see her sister for the next 3 decades. Laureen suddenly stopped contacting her family with no indication as to why or where she was going. A few weeks after Laureen's visit, Ruby was shocked when she received a bill in the mail for Laureen's engagement ring. 5 years later, Laureen had visited a mental hospital again, with still no word to her family. In 1985, the children Laureen had given up all those years earlier had found each other and reunited as adults. They had also tracked down Laureen's family and learned of her disappearance. Everyone was worried about her and did what they could to track her down, but nothing came of it. Laureen's mother passed away 3 years later, in 1988, and left a large inheritance for Laureen and all of her siblings. The courts assigned an attorney to look for her alongside her siblings and her children, so they could reunite and Laureen could receive her share of the inheritance. They were worried that her mental health had continued to decline, and that she could be homeless, unable to remember who she was, or that something even worse might have happened to her. In 1991, Laureen's family reached out on television to try to find her. In a twist of fate, Laureen saw the broadcast from her home in Little Rock, Arkansas, where she had been working as a housekeeper for the past 30 years. She called the number that had been provided on the broadcast and was put in touch with her family. Her sister Ruby flew out to Little Rock to pick her up and bring her back home to Austin. Laureen, now going by her first name, Vera, was finally reunited with her siblings and her children and was able to spend her remaining years living off of her inheritance, as if she was finally being rewarded for all of her hard work and struggles over the years.
Number 3. Brenda Heist.
Brenda, a 43-year-old woman from a small town in Pennsylvania, was a loving wife and mother until divorce threatened to tear apart the quiet life she had built with her family. She was working as a bookkeeper for a local car dealership at the time, but she didn't make enough to support herself on her own. As the divorce proceeded, Brenda had been trying to move into a new apartment, and she applied for government assistance to help her afford the rent, but she was denied. She was running out of options and facing homelessness, and the divorce was taking a huge toll on Brenda. February 8th, 2002, started as a day like any other. Brenda had set out meat to thaw for dinner and had just started a load of laundry when she had to leave to take her kids to school. After dropping them off, she had intended to go home to finish taking care of things around the house, but something came over her and caused her to drive to the bus station instead. Brenda was completely overwhelmed with her situation, especially at the thought that she might become a burden to her children and ex-husband if she couldn't find a way to support herself. After parking her car, she walked over to the bus station and found a bench to sit on, where she finally began to let out the feelings she had been keeping bottled up inside. Two strangers saw her sobbing on the bench and asked her if she was okay. Brenda never made it back home that day, and 4 days later, the police found her car where she had left it parked at the bus station. Everyone thought that she had been kidnapped, but there were no leads. As investigators became more and more convinced that there had been foul play, Brenda's soon-to-be ex-husband, Lee, became the number one suspect. Lee quit his job and eventually lost the family's house. As years passed and no new evidence surfaced, the suspicious circumstances of Brenda's disappearance led to it being labeled as a cold case homicide. In 2010, 8 years after Brenda went missing, Lee had Brenda declared dead by a court. He collected her life insurance money and married someone new. It wasn't until a few years later, after she had been missing for 11 years, that Brenda Heiss returned. Thinking that she had a warrant out for her arrest, Brenda had turned herself in. There had been no warrant, but through a strange series of events, Brenda Heiss had solved her own murder case by proving that she had not, in fact, been murdered at all. You see, Brenda had been so sure that she would become a burden to her family after the divorce was finalized that she had left with the two hitchhikers she had met at the bus station to start a new life on the road. Alongside her new companions, she made her way to Florida, where she lived a hard life on the streets for 11 years. She had believed that her family was better off without her and had chosen a lonely life on the streets instead of dragging them down with her. To survive, Brenda slept on the beach and under bridges and had worked various odd jobs, including cleaning boats, to earn money for food. Not long before she turned herself in, Brenda had gotten into trouble with the law for driving with an expired license plate and possession of substances. Brenda didn't fight the charges and served her 2-month sentence in a county jail. After it was revealed that Brenda was still alive, the family was reunited for a few news interviews, but the pain that everyone involved had experienced for over a decade had created too big of a gap to bridge.
Number 2. Alex Cooper. Alex was a 65-year-old man from British Columbia, Canada, who went missing in 1987. He was a successful musician who had a big family and a loving wife, and many children and grandchildren. In addition to his music career, he worked in the cleaning industry for nearly a decade before his disappearance. On April 4th, 1987, Alex's daughter Layla was driving with her husband when they saw her father's car on the side of the road. Thinking that he must be fishing at the nearby river, they decided to stop and check in on him since they were in the neighborhood. They parked their car next to his and walked down to the river where they expected to find Alex sitting on the bank with his fishing pole. He wasn't there though. So they began to search the area as Layla called her mother. Margaret, Alex's wife, said that she hadn't seen him in more than 24 hours. So they began contacting local hospitals, fearing the worst. None of the hospitals had records of Alex checking in, so Layla and her husband called the police to report her father missing. When the police arrived, they searched the area around Alex's car and the riverbank, but they found absolutely nothing that could help them find Alex Cooper. His fishing pole and tackle were in his locked car, as if he had indeed been on his way to go fishing before he vanished. The only thing investigators were able to uncover was that Alex had stopped for lunch at a restaurant that was only about a mile from his car. Alex's family worried that he had been robbed and murdered on the way back to his car, or that he may have had a heart attack and fallen into the river, but there was no evidence to back up either of those scenarios. The police believed that Alex may have simply chosen to leave his family behind for unknown reasons, but his family was firmly against that theory, arguing that he never would have abandoned his life willingly. An entire year passed with no new developments, and Alex was legally declared dead. This is where the story of Alex Cooper took a serious turn. His wife, Margaret, tried to apply for a copy of Alex's birth certificate for her records and ran into a big problem. According to the Canadian government's records, there was no birth certificate for Alex Cooper. Margaret tried to search for other records that she would be able to use to locate his birth certificate, but found that there were no records of Alex Cooper at all. Not until their marriage certificate from 1952. She tried looking for records from his high school, from his military draft registration, and from his medical history, but they all came up empty. It appears that Alex Cooper wasn't Alex Cooper after all. 4 more years passed as Alex's family tried to understand who the man they had lost was and why he had hidden his past from the people who loved him the most. The plot thickened on May 27th of 1991, when another disappearance was reported on the other side of Canada. A Toronto man who looked suspiciously similar to Alex Cooper, a man named David Cooper, who even had the same job as Alex, had apparently vanished as well. David Cooper wasn't actually missing though. He had been on a business trip and apparently hadn't informed a friend that he was leaving. After not hearing from him for a while, his friend had grown worried and reported him as missing. While he was gone, the police had searched his room in the boarding house he was staying at, and they had found a picture of Alex Cooper holding one of his grandchildren. That's when they realized that Alex and David were in fact the same person. Having no idea he had been reported missing, David returned to the boarding house after his business trip, where his landlady filled him in on what he had missed. She called the police to let them know that he wasn't missing after all, but before they could get there, he was already gone. Everyone was baffled. Why would a 65-year-old man with a successful business and loving family just run off? And what was the deal with his fake identities? Alex continued to evade detection for almost a year before a tip led police to his location. It was finally time for Alex Cooper to tell the whole story. His real name turned out to be Albin Arsene Arsenault, and as a young man, he had gotten a job working for the Union Pacific Railroad. At some point during his time there, Albin had been framed for a robbery at the railroad's office. Afraid that he would be falsely imprisoned because of the accusations, he had fled and changed his name to Alex Cooper. After meeting Margaret and building a family together, he was truly happy and had loved them all very much, but his past had come back to haunt him. After turning 65, he was expected to receive his pension, but he couldn't apply without a birth certificate. Unable to tell his family about his secret past, he had fled once again. After coming clean, Alex was able to reunite with his family, who were willing to accept him despite everything that had happened. Number 1. Tanya Ryder.
Tanya Ryder was 33 when she vanished for 8 horrifying days. She lived in Maple Valley, Washington, with her husband, Tom. The two of them each worked 2 jobs, tirelessly trying to save up money to build the home of their dreams. After leaving her shift at the Fred Meyers in the nearby town of Bellevue on September 20th, 2007, Tanya should have been headed home to Maple Valley, but she never showed up that day. Even though they lived together, it was common for Tom and Tanya to not see much of each other, due to the fact that they both worked so much. Tom's first clue that something was wrong came 2 days later when her manager from the Fred Meyers called to ask him if Tanya was okay. She hadn't shown up for her shifts over the previous 2 days and had never called to tell them she wasn't coming. This was very unlike Tanya, so both the manager and Tom became extremely worried. He tried to report her as a missing person, but was shockingly told that Tanya didn't meet the criteria for a missing person and that he should look for his wife himself. After talking to all of their friends and family, checking for activity on Tanya's bank account, and checking every single hospital, jail, and morgue in the area, Tom had found no trace of Tanya and, out of options, decided to call the police again the next day. It was already day 3 of Tanya's disappearance, and Tom was terrified that they were running out of time to find her. Finally, the police agreed to register Tanya as a missing person, and the search began. On day 4 of Tanya's disappearance, Tom was contacted by an investigator from the local police department, who asked him a series of questions about the case and was able to gain access to Tanya's bank account. There had been recent activity on her debit card, including over $1,600 in cash withdrawals since she had disappeared, which led the police to believe she wasn't missing and had simply left of her own volition. Unwilling to believe that his wife had suddenly abandoned him, Tom kept pushing. He realized that the activity on Tanya's card had actually been transactions he had made himself, and that there had been a miscommunication between him and the investigator due to the extreme stress he was under at the time. This immediately raised suspicion, and on the 8th day of Tanya's disappearance, Tom was escorted into a room at the police station to take a polygraph test. At the same time, the police were finally able to gain access to Tanya's phone records. They were able to get the location of the phone and began to search the area. They caught sight of Tanya's car at the bottom of a 20-foot-deep ravine and headed down to check it out. As they approach the vehicle, they are able to tell that there was a body inside the car. It was Tanya Ryder, and miraculously, after 8 days trapped inside the car with severe injuries and no access to food or water, she was alive. Tanya was rushed immediately to the emergency room at the nearest hospital, where she was put into a medically induced coma. Many of Tanya's bones were broken, and she was so dehydrated that her kidneys had begun to shut down. After a series of treatments and surgeries, Tanya eventually made a recovery and finally reunited with her husband, Tom. She had no memory of how she had ended up in the ravine and explained that she had suffered from severe hallucinations during the 8 days she had been trapped down there. She was extremely grateful to have made it out alive. Let us know what you think of these strange cases in the comments down below. If you love mysteries and spooky stories, like this video and don't forget to hit the subscribe button to keep up to date on our latest videos. A playlist is going to pop up right now with more videos you'll love. See you guys next time.